Daniel chapter 5, page 897. King Belshazzar made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords, and drank wine in front of 1,000. Belshazzar, when he tasted the wine, commanded that the vessels of gold and of silver that Nebuchadnezzar, his father, had taken out of the temple in Jerusalem be brought, that the kings and his lords, his wives, and his concubines might drink from them. Then they brought in the gold vessels that had been taken out of the temple, the house of God in Jerusalem. And the king and his lords, his wives, and his concubines drank from them. They drank wine and praised the gods of God, of gold and silver, bronze, iron, wood, and stone. Immediately the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace opposite the lampstand. And the king saw the hand as it wrote. Then the king's colour changed, and his thoughts alarmed him. His limbs gave way, and his knees knocked together. The king called loudly to bring in the enchanters, the Chaldeans, and the astrologers. The king declared to the wise men of Babylon, "Whoever reads this writing and shows me its interpretation shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold round his neck, and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom." Then all the king's wise men came in, but they could not read the writing or make known to the king the interpretation. Then King Belshazzar was greatly alarmed, and his colour changed, and his lords were perplexed. The queen, because of the words of the king and his lords, came into the banqueting hall, and the queen declared, "O king, live forever. Let not your thoughts alarm you, or your colour change. There is a man in your kingdom, in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. In the days of your father, light and understanding and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, were found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father the king, made him chief of the magicians, enchanters, Chaldeans, and astrologers, because an excellent spirit, knowledge, and understanding to interpret dreams, explain riddles, and solve problems were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar. Now let Daniel be called, and he will show you the interpretation." Then Daniel was brought in before the king. The king answered and said to Daniel, "You are that Daniel, one of the exiles of Judah, whom the king my father brought from Judah. I have heard of you that the spirit of the gods is in you, and that light and understanding and excellent wisdom are found in you. Now the wise men, the enchanters, have been brought in before me to read this writing and make known to me its interpretation. But they could not show the interpretation of the matter. But I've heard that you can give interpretations and solve problems. Now if you can read the writing and make known to me its interpretation, you shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold round your neck and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom." Then Daniel answered and said before the king, "Let your gifts be for yourself, and give your rewards to another. Nevertheless, I will read the writing to the king, and make known to him the interpretation. O king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar, your father, kingship and greatness and glory and majesty. And because of the greatness that he gave him, all peoples, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him. Whom he would, he killed, and whom he would, he kept alive. Whom he would, he raised up, and whom he would, he humbled. But when his heart was lifted up, and his spirit was hardened so that he dealt proudly, he was brought down from his kingly throne, and his glory was taken from him. He was driven from among the children of mankind, and his mind was made like that of a beast, and his dwelling was with the wild donkeys. He was fed grass like an ox, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven, until he knew that the Most High God rules the kingdom of mankind and sets over it whom he will. And you, his son, Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, though you knew all this, but you have lifted up yourself against the Lord of heaven. And the vessels of his house have been brought in before you, and you and your lords, your wives and your concubines have drunk wine from them. And you have praised the gods of silver and gold, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone, which do not see or hear or know. But the God in whose hand is your breath, and whose are all your ways, you have not honoured. Then from his presence the hand was sent, and this writing was inscribed. And this is the writing that was inscribed: Mene, Mene, Tekel, and Parson. This is the interpretation of the matter. Mene, God has numbered the days of your kingdom and brought it to an end. Tekel, you have been weighed in the balances and found wanting. Perez, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians. Then Belshazzar gave the command, and Daniel was clothed with purple. A chain of gold was put round his neck, and a proclamation was made about him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. That very night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was killed. And Darius the Mede received the kingship, received the kingdom, being about 62 years old.
Thank you. We're joining a series in Daniel that has been started over at St. Helens, but that Kev, I think, has given you a kind of run-up into last week. So we're picking up at chapter 5, which is a pair to chapter 4. Very similar events in many ways. Again, we are with high drama and major political upheaval. Let me show you absolute dictatorship in verse 19 of page 898. Verse 19, whom he would, he killed, or kept alive, or raised up, or humbled. That is what absolute power has always meant. I don't know if you saw on YouTube this week, King Jong-un's generals wading into freezing water up to their neck and waving and cheering, because he has that power over them. But then in verse 6, the same king, the king's colour changed, and his thoughts alarmed him, his limbs gave way, and his knees knocked together. We're inside a capital city under siege, and the paranoid dictator is no longer enjoying the party. It's quite a change. The chapter opens so well for him. 5 verse 1, we have a new king. He's inside the impenetrable walls of Babylon, the capital of the global superpower. He is America rather than North Korea in this political game. And he calls together 1,000 lords for a drinking game. But the chapter is driven by his fear. In front of his lords, his wives, his concubines, and all the wise men, he loses all control, even of his own body. Belshazzar is unraveled by fear and brought into conversation with a man who should be terrified of him, but is not. Daniel, just one Jewish man in conversation with absolute power. We're over 20 years on from chapter 4. There has been regime change, coup d'etat, and Daniel is an old man, not even remembered by the civil service he used to run. And a paranoid dictator with the army and the lords against a tired old exile who should be terrified but is not. See, this week in Daniel, Daniel will show us life when the powerful set themselves up against God, and he shows us why it is the powerful who should fear and the believers who should be confident. There's some headings on a notice sheet just inside the songs, and heading number one is that taking on God is for idiots. So in verse 1, verse 2, maybe it is the paranoia, maybe it is overconfidence, maybe it is calculated political propaganda, but Belshazzar goes for a huge feast. And probably there was food, but what we're told about is the wine. He drank wine, and he tasted the wine, and I think that means a lot of it, and he casts around for a way to demonstrate his absolute power. And he remembers there was a God that his predecessor Nebuchadnezzar made a huge fuss of. He issued big decrees like chapter 4, calling that God the Most High and King of Heaven, the one who rules the kingdoms of men. So since we're feeling powerful, let's take on that God. And the narrative slows down using repetition so that we take it frame by frame. The drunk king calls for those gold cups, the ones we took from the temple in Jerusalem. Well, yes, my lord, the king. And why? So we can drink from them. The king, his lords, his wives, his concubines. They have to go and fetch enough gold and silver for 1,000 lords and an imperial harem. And they have to open the locks, find the right chest, polish the silver, and bring them in. And by that time, the king's idea has gone further. We're not just going to get drunk from them. We're going to act out a deliberate act of sacrilege. Here is something the all-powerful conquering king Nebuchadnezzar would never have dared to do. We're going to drink wine, verse 4, from these cups and praise the gods of gold and silver, bronze, iron, wood, and stone. Belshazzar is going to demonstrate his power by taking on the Most High King of Heaven. And that is a move that's familiar from the history books. The French Revolution, they banned crosses and bells, and they enforced the worship of the goddess Reason in the Cathedral of Notre Dame. Soviet Russia aimed to eliminate religion entirely. They aimed to do that by allowing religion in private, but banning religious displays in public. They used propaganda and the media and the school syllabus to teach that science had now disproved all religious superstition. It's also a move familiar to anyone who's done any youth work. See, among teenagers, Ouija boards are not just open-minded religious experimentation. The band Black Sabbath could not just as easily have been Purple Tuesdays. And there is a reason why there are two shops opposite my bus stop that have windows full of Christian symbols. They're the scary shops, and they're printed upside down on T-shirts. Because if you can take on this God, then you can really show your independence, whoever you are. Show your total autonomy from any power or control, from the supreme ruler of the universe or from the mother who wants you to change your socks. Whichever way it is, if you can take on this God, then you are the boss of your life. And normally, the God of heaven ignores the teenage toy Satanist. And normally, he allows the dictator to run his course as well. But on this night, in 539 BC, God sends a message. Verse 5, immediately the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace opposite the lampstand. And the king saw the hand as it wrote. Belshazzar gets the full, genuine, supernatural treatment. A disembodied hand, clearly visible in the best-lit section of the palace, writing on the wall in letters that remain visible long after everybody is hoping this was just a drunken mistake. And the king goes from sort of boldly taking on gods to total desperation. His face changed, his thoughts out of control, his legs gone from under him, and he's shaking uncontrollably. The great and powerful king now has just one urgent, desperate need. He needs to know what this writing means. He must know. So he calls, presumably from the fourth floor, for his specialists. And they come in, the enchanters and the astrologers and the ancient court full of experts. They're offered money and the highest rank in the kingdom to whoever reads this writing. And they all file in, just as they did for Nebuchadnezzar in chapter 2, and again in chapter 4, and just like both times before, they cannot read the writing. And then Belshazzar really loses it. His colour changes again, he's like a cartoon chief in Asterix, and the man who fell over and shook on the floor before when he was alarmed, he is now greatly alarmed. And his lords are perplexed, and if that makes you think of 10 English aristocrats doing the cryptic crossword in their armchair, then think again. These are 1,000 drunken Oriental aristocrats with a palace floozy on every knee, and they're all shouting at each other in total panic. Until even the Queen Mother hears them, and she totters in on her Zimmer frame to deliver the antidote to colour-changing kings. See, she's old enough to remember that thrown away somewhere in the palace is an old man with understanding like the wisdom of the gods to interpret dreams, explain riddles, and solve problems. Your predecessor Nebuchadnezzar, your father the king, made him chief of all the magi. And the queen is wiser than all the experts who can't admit that they need the help of this old exile that they replaced. We don't know her name. People have speculated maybe she is Nebuchadnezzar's daughter who was married into this new dynasty to secure the throne. But she still remembers Daniel, who used to run the palace. See, Belshazzar has come a long way in seven verses. All powerful, go on God, let's have a fight, to shivering on the floor and needing his mum. See, taking on the God of Jerusalem seemed like such a good idea. But now Belshazzar, he knows two things for certain. First, he knows that God is real. Real as in powerful. Even here in his banqueting hall, 500 miles from Jerusalem. And the second thing he knows is that God is interested in him. Disembodied fingers have written a message. God is real. And God is interested in him. But he does not have a clue what God is saying. So he panics. Which is where Belshazzar of Babylon has the edge, I think, on much complacent confusion about God in the 21st century in London. See, both atheism and the kind of cuddly, confused Christianity that many atheists grew up with essentially says the same thing about God. Says even if he exists, you don't need to worry about him. The atheist buses we had a few years ago, they said, there's probably no God, so stop worrying and enjoy your life. And the Christian equivalent, I think, is, well, I like to think there is a God who wants you to stop worrying and enjoy your life. But if God is real and interested and communicating, as Belshazzar discovered, then we need to know what he is saying. And we should actually be as terrified as Belshazzar if we don't know what he's saying, even in complacent 21st century London. And if you're here and you've never been told that God is real and interested in you, and has spoken words that concern you, then I'm sorry about that. Many, many apologies, particularly if you're told by people in my job, in dog collars and pulpits, that God is vague and distant, or into hugs and comforting. The real God and Father of the Lord Jesus Christ is definite and present, and he is into love and justice, which is an entirely different proposition. And taking him on is for idiots. And they find Daniel, they offer him the royal bribe, and Daniel could not care less. Verse 17, let your gifts be for yourself and give your rewards to another. See, faced with supreme royal power, with its threats to kill and promises to reward, Daniel should be terrified, but is not. Because he is in his 70s now, Daniel. And he has tested the truth of God over seven decades of turbulent geopolitics. He has learned over a lifetime the message that is still wet in supernatural paint on the palace wall. So he is not afraid and says, I will read the writing to the king and make known to him the interpretation. And the interpretation is that taking on God is for idiots because, point two, even kings have a king. And Daniel keeps the king waiting for the miraculous writing and decides to give him a divine history lesson instead. And the point of this history lesson is to teach Belshazzar what it's like to be the one true God. So Daniel begins talking about his days at court, back in the days of King Nebuchadnezzar. And on your handout there's a diagram, and the one on the right shows you how the relationship works between a king like Nebuchadnezzar and everybody else on the planet. So Nebuchadnezzar, verse 18, was given kingship and greatness and glory and majesty. And verse 19, where the diagram says people, you may put in brackets all peoples, nations and languages, which is not flattery. That's just factual history. Nebuchadnezzar had personally conquered several very great multinational, multilingual global empires, most famously Assyria and Egypt. The gold and silver vessels that Belshazzar has just been drinking from, they were probably pretty hard to find because Nebuchadnezzar had done that to everywhere and piled them all back in some room in his palace. And the arrows on your diagram, they represent the relationships between a king and his people. Verse 19, so what flows up from the people to the king is they trembled and feared beforehand. And what flows down is total absolute power. Whom he would, he killed, or kept alive, or raised up, or whom he would, he humbles. That is just how it is with absolute power. I remember when I was 18 realizing that I would never have real executive power ever again. When I was 18, I had a school jacket, and I had two different sorts of paper in the two pockets. There were blue chits in here, and one of those with your name on it meant that you had to get up early in the morning and see the deputy head. That was the blue chit. But the pink chit meant you had to get up extra early in the morning and go for a run with the deputy head. And so all you had to do was blue chits in here, pink chits in here, and a never-ending supply of power. But if tiny power can go to the head of 18-year-olds, then imagine absolute world-striding power in the head of a king like Nebuchadnezzar or Belshazzar. You've got the third in the kingdom chits in one pocket, you've got the slave for life chits in the other. Off with his head, or mercy and live. And obviously, the right response to a king like that is trembling and fear. That was on the most basic political survival course. That was every normal day in King Belshazzar's life. But the diagram on the right is too limited. It's too zoomed in, too narrow, because verse 18 said that the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar his greatness, which is why the diagram on the left has one more layer, because even kings have a king. All their power comes from God, even if they got it by conquest, like Nebuchadnezzar, or by palace coup, like Belshazzar. Which means there are arrows of relationship between God and the king, just as surely as there are between the king and the people. And if Belshazzar knows all about ruling the people, he shouldn't be so slow to see the similarities between him and God. And in the history lesson, what Daniel does is give you basically the talk that Kev gave you last week on Daniel chapter 4. Your predecessor Nebuchadnezzar, well, what did he send up the arrow towards God? Verse 20, there was a heart lifted up, a spirit hardened, and he dealt proudly. What Daniel doesn't need to say is, how would you respond to a subject like that, King Belshazzar? And verse 21 tells you what happened 20 years ago, the madness of King George, the regression of King Nebuchadnezzar to living like an animal until he recognized that God is the boss, that the world is really and truly like the left-hand diagram. At which point God responds much more generously than any normal human monarch, and Nebuchadnezzar is restored. Verse 22, and you, his son, Belshazzar, how have the arrows been going in your relationship with God? Have not humbled yourself, though you knew all this. Not humble, but verse 23, lifted yourself up against the Lord of heaven. So even Nebuchadnezzar just went for pride. He didn't try and take God on. Not one of his gods, the gods of gold and silver, wood, stone and bronze, they do not stand a chance of protecting you against the Lord of heaven. Your arrows going up have been all hostility and pride and asking for a fight, but he is the God, end of verse 23, in whose hand is your breath. And I love the fact that still, Daniel has not told him what the writing means. The thing that Belshazzar has been quivering and colouring, changing and falling on the floor about, he still hasn't told him, because all he's done is teach him the difference between even a very important human being and God. Just a basic history lesson about the people who've done his job recently. Because really, Belshazzar knows what the writing has to say. And that is why he fell shaking to the floor. Even if he's deluded most of his brain into thinking he has sort of supreme autonomous authority, there is a part of his soul caged up at the back and hammering to be let out before the rest gets them into some real trouble that's saying, well, what Daniel says, you, his son Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, though you knew all this. And again, I think we can have more sympathy, maybe, with Belshazzar of Babylon than with much of our complacently casual rebellious culture. See, Belshazzar, he actually ruled the world. I can understand how he became confused and thought that there was no higher power over him. It certainly makes more sense for him to think that than for somebody who rules the derivatives desk or the classroom or a political party. And Belshazzar had a palace and enough wives and concubines to feast 1,000 lords and a treasurer full of the treasure that every other king in his area had spent hundreds of years collecting from all over the world. I can understand why he became confused and thought that he had everything that he needed and that no one could take it away from him. Certainly it makes more sense for him to think that than for somebody with 2 cars or 4 bedrooms or private health insurance. If he took on God more dramatically, using God's own golden cups to praise gods he'd made up, well, that's just he had better toys lying around. That was an accident of circumstance and opportunity. Where our culture takes these lives that God has given us, the breath that is in the hand of God, the bodies that God has made, and decides to lift our heart up and harden our spirits and deal proudly. Our culture, including me so very often, says to God, I will do what I want, what seems best to me, as if God had never existed, had never sent his son, had never spoken. And the actual verdict on Belshazzar doesn't take long for Daniel to tell at all. What God has done is write the names of 4 coins on the wall. Verse 25, mene, mene, tekel, parsin, which is roughly a pound, tuppence and 50p, which is to reduce Belshazzar's life and reign to check stubs and bank statements. But there is more to it. God gives Daniel understanding below that, because each unit of currency has a verb that sounds just like it. So mene sounds like numbered. And verse 26, God has numbered the days of your kingdom and brought it to an end. Tekel sounds just like weight. Verse 27, and God has weighed you on his scales and found you wanting. And parsin sounds like divided, which is exactly what God is going to do to your kingdom. Your final humiliation will be to be succeeded by coalition government, the Medes and the Persians. And it is no accident that those are the things that autonomous humanity most hates about the idea of gods. And the author Philip Pullman, if you've heard of him, says his aim is to find a way of believing that we are not subservient creatures dependent on the whim of some celestial monarch, but free citizens of the Republic of Heaven. And if you've read the children's stories he wrote, you'll know that there's a key moment in them where the children effectively euthanize God. And from then on, they can be free. There's probably no God. Now stop worrying and enjoy your life. But Belshazzar learned that there certainly is a God. A God who meets our claims to autonomy with the absolute authority over the number of our days. How can you take on a God who chooses when you'll die, who has your breath in his hands? A God who has the moral authority to weigh us, not because he wants to prevent enjoyment in life, but because he cares how we live and is interested in us and in all the other people we bump into, and who sees our selfishness and greed and anger and the consequences it has in the world, and he weighs us. And Belshazzar meets the God who can take all our achievements and divide them, pull them down, and give them to other people. All your ways are his. And the story ends with Belshazzar simply in shock, I think. He gives the command in verse 29 on autopilot. Daniel, in his 70s, stands there dignified as he allows the servants to dress him in what he knows are absolutely meaningless robes. The king says, you can be third ruler in the kingdom. But Daniel knows that is a power with only minutes left to run. Because, verse 30, that very night Belshazzar the Chaldean king was killed and Darius the Mede received the kingdom. Now let me finish with some applications. So that's point 3. So kings, be humble, and believers, be confident. See, this chapter has 2 audiences. Daniel chapter 2 to 7, they're written not in the language that Daniel learned at home as a child, not in the language of the prophecies he read or the psalms he prayed, but they're written in the language he learned to administer an empire and advise kings. They're written in Aramaic, and so uniquely in the Bible, they stand out as words addressed to the world that has power over believers, rather than addressed to believers themselves. So this is a direct address to powerful people who want to oppress the people of God. And Belshazzar doesn't really get much of a chance to get going, but some of the others do with their fiery furnaces and their pits full of lions. And the final chapters of the book predict a future full of powerful empires who will mistreat the people of God. What does God say to them in their power and their bold-faced taking on of God? Well, we've said much of this already. God says even kings have a king. And it doesn't make any difference whether you believe in him or not, or whether you call yourself the Council of Deputies or the Supreme Soviet or the local council of an English market town. Just as surely as you exercise human authority over those below you, Daniel 5 says God exercises greater authority over you. Greater and more utterly real. And once you know all this, as Belshazzar did, then the lesson is to copy his predecessor Nebuchadnezzar and humble yourself. Recognize that all authority comes from God and can be redistributed by him whenever he chooses. And that ultimately, at the point of death, it is God's weighing that matters more than any human achievement. And the events in our passage, the events of 539 BC, they are just one more piece of evidence that God can really do this. Don't know if you know that Daniel 5 was one of those chapters that used to be treated as a classic case of God or the Bible getting its history wrong. We had never heard of a king called Belshazzar. But worse than that, we knew who was king of Babylon when it fell. We knew his name. His name was Nabonidus, not Belshazzar. So people said, God doesn't control history. He makes it up to fool the gullible. Which is a nice reminder of how incomplete our knowledge of the past is. Because in 1881, somebody found something called the Nabonidus Cylinder, 60 kilometers north of Babylon. It's now in Berlin with a copy in the British Museum just down the road. And we now know that Nabonidus had a son called Belshazzar. And we know that Nabonidus got a bit bored of ruling and being king, so he retired for most of his life and made Belshazzar king instead and retreated to an oasis. And we know that it was only as the Persians invaded that Nabonidus came out of retirement and commanded the army in a big battle quite a long way away from Babylon, which means on the night that Cyrus surprised everybody by sending a general ahead to attack Babylon without warning, the man in charge on the ground was Belshazzar, co-regent, co-king with his father Nabonidus, which makes really good sense of his offer to make somebody third ruler in the kingdom. Belshazzar can't make anybody second ruler in the kingdom because that's his job. And the sudden downfall of the king ruling in Babylon fits the historical record very well. We've got different accounts of what happened that night. Some accounts say the city was so fed up that they opened the gates to the Persians, but Herodotus says the Persians diverted the Euphrates, which allowed the Persians to wade into the city through the sewers. If that's true, then even as Daniel is telling the king, you can keep your gifts, the water level is dropping. Dangerously, dangerously low. And even as Daniel is explaining that your days are numbered and your kingdom is given to the Medes and the Persians, there are Medes and Persians waist deep in the stink, in the sewer underneath them, inside the famously strong walls, and just about to bring down the greatest empire in the world. See, Belshazzar needs to humble himself before he meets his maker in judgment. And the good news, even for a world opposed to God's people, with Daniel 4 in front of him, is that this God is the God who gives second chances, even to kings like Nebuchadnezzar, and certainly to anybody here. That's one way it needs to be read. But we also need to hear what this passage says to the second audience, to believers. And I think probably our situation only occasionally looks like Daniel's in detail. But the truths that give backbone to that 70-year-old man in Babylon can give us the same thing in our smaller trials. So why isn't Daniel scared? And there are lots of reasons why he should be. This king only has to say a word, and he is dead. And the government of Belshazzar that night was a particular fever pitch of arrogance and defiance of God and intoxication and paranoia and guilt. You'd think he should be scared. And more than that, you'd think he should have given up on God. And you see that, I think, reading between the lines. You get a sense for Daniel's position. He is no longer one of the wise men. When we last heard, he was their boss. He's not remembered by anybody but the old queen, even when they're terrified. And they have to go and find him from wherever it is they've buried him away. And from sources outside the Bible, we can confirm what Daniel's first audience would have known. We are 20 years on from the death of Nebuchadnezzar. We are 15 years on from the coup that brought Nabonidus and his co-ruler Belshazzar to power. And it doesn't take much imagination to think what a blow to the confidence of Daniel that might have been. See, Daniel believes in the promises of God. He goes on believing in those promises, even after Jerusalem is conquered repeatedly. And people like him are carried 500 miles to live among their enemies. He goes on believing those promises while Jerusalem is burnt down and the temple is destroyed. He believes that God has promised to rebuild Jerusalem and send them home. And he had 45 years of pretty good news, really. He saw God act to change the heart of the ruler of the superpower of the age, the one who'd need to make that decision to send them home. Nebuchadnezzar, he doesn't start particularly well, but he seems to be responding to treatment and humbling himself and issuing proclamations about the God of Jerusalem, and he makes Daniel prime minister, and surely it is only a short step from here to the promises coming true. But the point of Daniel chapter 5 is that Belshazzar is nothing like Nebuchadnezzar. He hates God. He deliberately takes him on. Daniel is sacked and retired, and everything has come apart. And the amount of time God has said it would take for the promises to come true is nearly over. There's 3 or 4 years left on the clock. There is no human way to spot a good outcome from here. What seemed so promising 20 years ago is all falling apart. And again, throughout history, there have been plenty of moments when Christians thought they could guess that God was about to do great things. During the 1850s, half the population of England went to church regularly. I think maybe that's the moment. We got half. We're nearly there. Or again, in the 1950s, after two world wars, people were looking for meaning and packing out the churches, packing out Wembley to hear Billy Graham. Or maybe we think there's something in our age that God will definitely use, church planting or evangelistic courses or something. Well, maybe. Who knows? We have a powerful, promising God. But Daniel 5 is here to prepare us for times when things are getting harder, when our big hopes have been disappointed and there is no human way for a good outcome. It's especially hard, isn't it, to keep trusting if things seem so close and have now gone wrong. But Daniel has clearly not stopped trusting. We don't know what the spiritual life of this man has been like in between, but every time this man is summoned into the life or death audience chamber with the king, he shows he really believes that that king has a king. And the king of heaven has made promises to his servant Daniel, promises that he is going to and learn confidence, I think, from Daniel's experience and Daniel's example, from Daniel's history. Because that night, Belshazzar, the king who hated God, is killed. And the kingdom, it says, is received by a 62-year-old man called Darius. We think he's probably the Persian general. He's the sort of deputy, Median deputy, of the new emperor Cyrus the Persian. So that night, the people of God fall under the rule of Cyrus the Great. And Cyrus the Great is quoted twice in the Bible, in 2 Chronicles 36 and in Ezra chapter 1, in the first year of his rule, so within 365 days of the night when everything seemed to be going wrong, Thus says Cyrus, king of Persia, the Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth. See, he's been listening to Daniel chapter 5. And he, the Lord, has charged me. Exactly on time, only months after all the world was being ruled by an absolute dictator who was so opposed to God he thought he could take him on directly. Who would have thought it? Only somebody who believes a promise from God is a promise from the king over all other kings. Let's pray. Dear Father God, we praise you that you are King and Lord. You know that our sinful hearts would love to rule our own lives, would love to be autonomous from you. But yet we praise you that you are good and right and loving and just, and that you rule over all powers in this world. Lord God, please would we humble ourselves where we try to fight you, and would we trust you where we might be scared. Trust you that your promises always come true, and you are the good, reliable and powerful God. And we praise you in your Son, Jesus' name. Amen.